Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in History. My name is Christine Lamberson and I'll be your host today. Today I'll be speaking to Christopher Agee, whose book, The Streets of San Francisco, Policing and the Creation of a Cosmopolitan Liberal Politics from 1950 to 1972, came out with the University of Chicago Press in 2014. Hi, Chris. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Christine. Thank you.
So I think we'll just start out by having you tell me a little bit about yourself and how you became a historian.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me on. I'm a U.S. urban historian. I study policing. I did my PhD in the Bay Area, and that's where I started this book. And I think I became a historian probably for the reasons most people do. I like the research. I like teaching. I liked sort of the investigatory part of it. I liked... For instance, on my project, looking at something near where I was living, which allowed me to conduct oral histories, allowed me to sort of move beyond the archives into people's homes and see their personal collections. That was sort of how I got into history and this project in particular.
And how did you come to decide to focus on policing in particular?
So yeah, it was not by design. I was in a graduate research seminar, and I knew I wanted to do something local. And it was on crime. The seminar itself was on crime, and I had heard of a scandal in the 1960s in San Francisco called the Gayola scandal, in which a bunch of patrol officers and sergeants were accused of extorting money from gay bars in the city. So they were accused of taking payola, and so the press kind of dubbed it the Gayola scandal. And I figured because there was a very long trial revolving around this scandal, I figured there would be a lot of papers and a lot of records from the event. And so I sort of set out to research that, and very quickly I discovered there were no papers left, and there were no records. They'd all been sort of destroyed. And so that forced me to start going directly into some oral histories. And I started talking with gay bar owners who'd been involved in the scandal, and police officers and journalists and politicians from the era. And it was fortuitous, because they started telling me a story that was really different than the story I expected to find. A lot of the literature up until that point had emphasized police chiefs and big raids and sweeps and sort of large police actions. And that was sort of what dominated most of the policing literature, and certainly the literature on police and the gay and lesbian community. But the interviews very quickly were telling me a different story. They were, all these people were emphasizing kind of the day-to-day interactions between them and between police and gay bar owners, and were emphasizing how little connection patrol officers had on the street to the police chief or the mayor that instead police officers were acting with a lot of discretion. And that actually that the Gayola scandal was really a scandal revolving around discretion, that there was a new reform police chief in San Francisco during that period, and he wanted to, for his own reasons, centralize power within the police department, take away discretion, and then the gay bar owners wanted to be free of these payola demands, these extortion demands, and so it had created sort of this strange and very temporary alliance between this chief and these gay bar owners in order to get rid of the discretion police officers enjoyed over gay bars. And that sort of kicked things off. I then wrote a dissertation, and then that sort of slowly morphed into a book where I was looking at different types of discretion that police were enjoying throughout San Francisco during this period, Chinatown and North Beach, Haight-Ashbury, black neighborhoods, Fillmore and Hunters Point. I assume we'll talk about those areas later. As with the Gayola story, I became interested in how discretion was really a defining feature of mid-century policing, and thinking about, when we account for discretion, when we account for the fact that police officers were acting on their own, weren't necessarily following the mandates and rules of their superior officers or politicians. How does that change our understanding of politics in the 1950s and 60s, and how does it change our understanding of how democracy was working?
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you're telling this story about changes, not just in police discretion, but in kind of larger reform and political change of the place of police in San Francisco during this period of time. And so I was wondering if you've already gotten a little bit into this, but if you might talk just a little bit about how policing worked sort of leading into this era of reform. So you've talked a bit about the role of discretion and the role of payola, but I was wondering if you could just expand on that part a little bit, and then we can talk more about what kinds of changes are coming about.
Right. So, my book is sort of one of the main takeaways of it is that there are these periods in the 20th century where sort of old policing practices and principles are being challenged, police legitimacy is being questioned, and then policing needs to, undergo this period of redemption. They need to sort of reclaim their legitimacy. And this happens, in these sort of episodically throughout the 20th century. In the 1950s and 60s, are sort of the biggest challenge to police legitimacy. And that's sort of what my story is about. It's the period where policing changes the most. Between the mid-19th century and the 1940s, policing had changed very little. The policing coming out of World War II looked a lot like the policing in the late 19th century. Police in most cities had two primary functions. One was to collect graft for the political machine, and the other function was sort of a broad order maintenance function where they were responsible for policing culture and sexuality and racial boundaries and sort of whatnot, sort of a wide range of activities. And they did that with these sort of broad status-based charges like vagrancy, which really allowed you to arrest someone for nearly anything. They didn't have to commit a crime they didn't have to do anything. It was a status-based charge. In a place like San Francisco, what that meant was that in places like Chinatown, you had a rule in San Francisco, and this was typical of other cities, where regular police couldn't go in the neighborhood. There was sort of a special division in there, and they operated out of a secret hideout, and they didn't wear uniforms. They wore these fancy suits that made them look like police detectives from the movies. And they would go around sort of, creating their own sort of law. And in North Beach, I tell a story about an officer who walked around North Beach and sort of created his own sort of index card file on citizens of the neighborhood. He would stop people on the street and make them tell him his information, or he would walk into their apartments. And sort of every neighborhood sort of has versions of this. So this is, you know, in African American neighborhoods, there's sort of this split where there's a problem of certainly over policing. There's a lot of brutality. Police sort of, you know, storming into people's apartments, you know, beating people around their kitchen table, real sort of intense acts of violence. And there's a lot of under policing where they just completely remove themselves from a neighborhood, don't respond to violence within the area. And all of this is sort of setting the table then. And then in the 1950s and 60s in San Francisco, but then as I discussed in my book, a lot of other cities as well, San Francisco is on the front end of this change, but it really is a national change. You suddenly have this coalescence of, you know, my book identifies sort of three major channels that are, they're all coalescing into one big reform movement, so that suddenly in the space of 20 years, that system that had existed for the previous 100 sort of gets wiped away, and entirely new terms of policing are set. And so my book sort of talks about, you know, on the one hand, and this is the part that maybe had been at least recognized before, was that you get this whole wave of police reform campaigns coming out from marginalized communities themselves, African-Americans, civil libertarians, political radicals, sexual minorities. They're all sort of encountering and bringing attention to challenging abusive order maintenance policing. But then there's sort of the two elements that my book talks about that you know, and why I argue that, you know, the reforms of the 50s and 60s were so substantial, that there's sort of two other changes occurring. One is that in San Francisco and elsewhere, you get the rise of these sort of pro-growth downtown business people who are wresting power from old political machines and trying to get redevelopment monies to sort of remake their downtowns. And they recognize right off the bat that police officers are maintaining the old machines, that are sustaining the old machines. The graft that police take is propping up the old machines, so the old bosses. So these downtown business elites began attacking police graft. And they, in the process, began discovering discretion and began seeing discretion as a problem. And, of course, these elites don't want to expand civil rights. They're not interested in changing the boundaries of sexuality or of gender. But their challenges to discretion sort of produce these unintended consequences. Namely, they began sort of bringing in these sort of new, as they changed their downtowns, these young white collar people began moving into cities like Chicago and San Francisco and New York and L.A. And even small, you know, sort of cities in the middle of America, St. Louis and whatnot. And these white collar people began sort of combining the two messages of the downtown elites and also of the civil rights campaigns. On the one hand, they began, to bring the two arguments together, they began challenging the discretion that police officers use over black people, over gay people, over artists, and began arguing that, well, that this is unjust, and that really, but they go beyond that. They begin using these discussions of discretion to argue that cities should redefine crime, that crime should not be based around morals. Crime shouldn't be based around sort of understandings of family values, but that instead crime should be redefined around the concept of harm. And in each of my chapters, I'm showing how these young white collar downtown people are making sort of bridging alliances with either the Beats or gay bar owners or artists or African Americans. And with each of them arguing against police discretion and arguing that instead of the police sort of challenging the morals of each of these groups, police should be instead dedicating themselves to policing violence, that violence is the true threat to the city. So that's what's coalescing during this period. And the second half of the book, you know, discusses this, but also begins to make clear that there's a big caveat to all of this. And that's as these young liberals begin to redefine crime, redefine crime around harm, they're doing so in very racialized ways. They are increasingly associating harmless activities with white people. So they see the Beats as white, you know, regardless of whether or not they are white. They see gay and lesbian in bars as whites. They begin seeing artists as whites and defending them on those terms. Meanwhile, they begin seeing African Americans, well, not begin, but sort of drawing a line now where they're pointing to African Americans as pathologically violent, that violence is sort of baked into African American culture. And so the caveat then that they create here is that while, you know, crossing gender boundaries or sexual boundaries or for whites is considered harmless, they continue to see these activities as harmful when coming from African Americans. And as we can discuss, that will affect how they sort of the new direction they point policing in.
So you are talking about how there's a large number of alliances coming between people who have been policed through these various discretionary practices, and those folks are coming together with some of the pro-growth advocates. And I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about how those alliances are being formed and how they're playing out, and perhaps we can talk a bit about the Beats as an example of that.
Great. Yeah, sure. The Beats come near the beginning of the book, and they were in the North Beach neighborhood. The Beats are important in my book because it's really where you start seeing the emergence of these downtown young white liberals. These, incidentally, I should say, should have said earlier, are the cosmopolitan liberals that my book is referencing. So what's happening in the Beats? So the North Beach chapter focuses on a few specific patrol officers in particular. The patrolman Bigorani, who I mentioned earlier, he's sort of known as the scourge of North Beach, and also begins to set up the ways in which the harm principle is being introduced to San Francisco, and also the ways in which the harm principle is immediately being racialized. In terms of alliances, I guess what you see there is the Beat scene emerges kind of as a cultural phenomenon in the mainstream press and the mainstream entertainment, just as the pro-growth people are getting power in San Francisco. So in the mid-1950s, the pro-growth downtown business elites, they finally win control of City Hall in San Francisco. The person carrying the banner for them is Mayor George Christopher, and he immediately begins promising a crackdown on discretion because he associates it with payola, with extortion, with machine. And the problem that he doesn't anticipate is that the Beats, who are in North Beach, start getting attention, and they are tired of the police repression that they are encountering, and they immediately began framing that repression as an act of police discretion. You know, they certainly are talking about their rights, but they're also talking about their abuse in these sort of administrative terms as a problem of out of control patrol officers. And this puts Christopher and the downtown elites in a bit of a bind, because they've campaigned on ending discretion, and yet this is sort of a discretion they want to protect. They don't, you know, these downtown elites have no interest in the Beats. And so this, and then this is then where these white collar professionals, many of whom are these young people are going to the Beats. They're the people in the Beat bars. They're the people buying the Beat poetry. They are, in some instances, profiting off of the Beats as landlords. They began, this is the very beginning of them beginning to argue, well, wait a second, this discretion is wrong too. And this discretion is wrong because these people are not committing crimes. That wearing a beard, playing bongo drums on the street, not having a job, these should not be crimes. This isn't what crime is. And police are threatening us, or well, are endangering our city by policing the Beats because there's violence in the city that they aren't policing, that they're instead focused on these harmless activities. And so that's the kind of alliance, you know, in many instances that I'm talking about. It's not, you know, these aren't alliances in a political party. These aren't alliances in any sort of formal institutional way, but they are expressions of support that over the course of my book began manifesting themselves either in new legislation or in people's elections. In the Beat case in particular, what you see is out of this idea of the harmless Beat, liberals beginning in San Francisco and then organizing throughout the state, began to challenge California's vagrancy law, arguing that police are using vagrancy, which is a broad status-based charge, to arrest people who've not committed any crime, much less any sort of harmful activity. And their campaign is successful. California repeals its vagrancy law in 1961, making it only the second state in the country to repeal common vagrancy. By 1972, the Supreme Court of the United States is voiding vagrancy law. This is sort of the beginning. California's sort of on, and San Francisco in particular, is on the front end of that process. And I guess I would just say finally that the Beats right off the bat also are useful because they show us many of the limits. Starting with common vagrancy, California eliminates common vagrancy, but they immediately replace it with a lewd vagrancy code that still gives police broad discretion over gay and lesbian people. The reforms in this book that I describe are very incremental, and that's why sort of each chapter is necessary, because one campaign begets another campaign. And then the other point that you see from the North Beach story is that what I sort of alluded to earlier is that young white collar people, these cosmopolitan liberals, express support for Beats and express tolerance of Beats as harmless people on the understanding that that they're going to understand Beats as white, and this is most clear in their support for one Beat in particular, a guy named Bob Kaufman. Bob Kaufman was an African American poet, and he was probably the main target of Officer Bigorani's, you know, violence and ire, and their relationship was a relationship deeply based around race. Bigorani said repeatedly he didn't want African Americans in the North Beach neighborhood. And Kaufman definitely understood that his challenges to police as sort of this assertive beat were the challenges of an African-American man. He understood his challenges to be racial in nature. But the press really ignored all of their run-ins with one another, and there were frequent run-ins, and they were often quite violent. And they only sort of, cosmopolitan liberals only sort of paid any attention and sort of turned towards their relationship when it revolved around Kaufman posting a dirty poem about Officer Bigorani in a cafe, and Bigorani came and tore it down. And so suddenly the cosmopolitan liberals in the press pay attention, because this is a story that they can describe as a censorship story. They never discuss in the coverage of this that Kaufman is African American, and it's the exception that proves the rule. That they're focusing on African American beats, but not discussing race. And then there are smaller examples in that are sort of the reverse of that, where they would discuss police officers violently, committing acts of brutality against African Americans, but they would in North Beach, but they wouldn't discuss it as a beat issue. They would just sort of discuss it as a general citywide race issue. So you start seeing here the ways in which cosmopolitan liberals are teasing apart their attitudes towards harm in African Americans and harm in whites.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about race. And I have sort of two directions that I'm interested in. You can kind of go in the direction you'd like. One is, as the book goes along, you're talking about how the further you go, these cosmopolitan liberals are aiming for inclusiveness and start sort of talking in that kind of rhetoric while saying, employing this harm principle for policing. And thus, racial inclusiveness seems like an obvious possibility, but they have this uncomfortable relationship there. So I'm wondering sort of how that works is one aspect. And right. Then the other aspect is you mentioned briefly already that Black communities in San Francisco, as in many other places, have this sort of dual problematic relationship with the police, where they're simultaneously over-policed but also neglected. And that creates particular challenges for residents who are trying to implement some sort of reform. They have sort of two very, very different problems going on at the same time in this problematic mm-hmm. relationship with the police. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that relationship and then how they're making this argument to be part of this pluralism and how that's going.
Right. Okay. Yeah, great. So so the cosmopolitan liberals, they develop as a group with its own ideology through the course of the book. And I should say, that in 1967, there's an election and Mayor Joseph Alioto, or candidate Joseph Alioto, is elected mayor. And I sort of point to him as the first actually sort of cosmopolitan liberal mayor. So there are sort of politicians who then begin to embody this mm-hmm. idea. And then in respect to the African American communities, I think those two questions are related. Liberals began separating, these cosmopolitan liberals really began separating themselves from earlier generations of liberals and conservatives in particular, in that earlier generations had argued that politics needed to be colorblind, that you really needed to not evince any sort of racial perspective in policymaking or in political discourse, and that speaking in racial terms, speaking with racial perspectives, would incite racial violence. And of course, this was a way of denying African Americans and other people of color, although even in San Francisco, African Americans, sort of dominated understandings of wide understandings of what race meant, denied African Americans a voice, and allowed whites to speak as whites, but without addressing that fact. What the cosmopolitan liberals are doing, their argument is different. Their argument is that we should allow for racial pluralism in politics, that we should allow different racial perspectives to enter political discourse. But again, it comes with a catch, and it's tied to this harm principle. Their assumption is that African Americans, you know, particularly working class and youth, have a dangerous, culture. Their notion is that by integrating black people into the political process and allowing them to speak with those voices in the process will be a way of diffusing sort of the black population, that the black population can be negotiated with. And so the way this then begins to play out in my book is that you start getting these in neighborhoods in all black neighborhoods, under policing and over policing is a problem. And one way that African American communities are responding to the problem of under policing is by creating service agencies that then work with youth, particularly youth gang leaders, and sort of working to negotiate peace treaties amongst them, and also working to recruit gang leaders as peacekeepers. And cosmopolitan liberals become really enchanted with this idea, this notion that they can find a few black youth basically to work through, and that will be a way of reducing what through the 60s becomes an increasing amount of inter-neighborhood violence within African-American neighborhoods. Liberals, that separates them. Cosmopolitan liberals work with these gang leaders. And they also then begin trying to create police reforms within the police department that will sort of mimic that model. They begin introducing police community relations units. San Francisco had probably one of the more robust police community relation units in the country. It would later serve as a model for early forms of community policing a couple decades later. What was I going to say about that? Oh, right. So that and the idea is that these police community relations units will learn to, in the rhetoric of the time, will speak the language of the community, will learn how to speak to the community. And essentially that means, speaking with a racial perspective. So liberals are very progressive liberals are trying to be progressive on this end and are offering African Americans new avenues into politics, although in very circumscribed ways, only insofar as African Americans can promise to sort of negotiate and help keep the peace. The cosmopolitan liberals are much less successful and have much fewer answers for over-policing. And this really comes down to a lack of commitment to that, solving that problem. Throughout the book, they continue white politicians, liberals in particular, continue to see African Americans as a violent community, and are really hesitant to do much to the police that will rein in brutality. But they're also facing, in addition to their own sort of hesitance, they're also facing kind of a state-building problem. With things like the Police Community Relations Unit, it's much easier to handle under policing because you can simply build more policing. You can build, better policing. You can build more responsible policing. You can build new programs. But in terms of over-policing, that's a problem of reining these agents of the state in. And that's much more complicated in terms of just how the police department works. Police officers are out on the street. They're not supervised. It's hard to keep constant supervision over them. They're running into, administrative problems, even when they want to, in terms of reining in the over-policing. And so this is then something African-Americans by the end of the book, are very much catching on to and are setting up one of the problems that's now at the center of our politics, sort of for the 30 years after this story, how to address under-policing in ways that don't simply exacerbate the over-policing.
Mm-hmm. So on that note, one of the things you talk about specifically with Alioto is that he is simultaneously promising to create this kind of inclusiveness and also provide tougher law enforcement, which is similarly difficult. And so I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about sort of how that promise works or how that's supposed to work, as well as how the difficulties that do come up.
Yeah, well, so Alioto assumes that, listen, if I allow all of this pluralism in the city, cultural, sexual, racial, and I allow all voices into City Hall, and we have a great big debate, you know, he was very into sort of the idea of robust debate sort of under the dome of City Hall, that City Hall will then be able to produce policies that serve the common good, right? Which he's assuming will fit with the harm principle, and that the city, in terms of policing, will be able to set policies that everyone can agree upon, that City Hall will then direct police to allow harmless activities to continue and instead focus itself on harmful activities. And so his belief is that he can eliminate discretion, right? And Alioto begins introducing, well, on the one hand, he's promoting the community relations unit because he likes the notion of it sort of working cooperatively with with the different marginalized communities. But he also sort of counterintuitively introduces a tax squad. And for Alioto and his supporters, this paramilitary tactical squad is democratic, is a liberal instrument. He believes that this tax squad, because they all have sort of this paramilitary training in order to get into it. They all march around in lockstep formation. He thinks that this tax squad will remain obedient to City Hall, and that City Hall, which is democratically designing policies, will be able then to direct this tax squad against acts of violence sort of violence that threatens the entire city. So that's sort of his belief on how he can be both democratic and sort of hard-nosed. And the problem that quickly develops is that the tax squad is not necessarily under his command. And that there are some high-profile events that the tax squad polices, but there's a lot of days in between where the tax squad just sort of roams around the city committing sort of very unprofessional acts of violence. And also the tax squad begins stoking a new assertiveness amongst rank-and-file officers. It's very inspiring. They like this this much more martial approach to policing. And the tax squad begins to breed a new subculture within the police department, and particularly amongst the rank and file, that do not see themselves as liberals, to say the least, or as part of Alioto's sort of reliable coalition. They see themselves as their own voice. And so what I get at the end of the book is that you've got Alioto believing that he can sort of create this much larger, martial, and obedient police department, but what he in fact produces is a police department with what grows into a very sort of strong police union movement. And by the end of the book, under his administration, the police union emerges from this story as a new and very powerful police player in San Francisco. And that's a story that is typical of the late 60s and early 70s in a lot of cities in America.
So could you talk a little bit more about how the police themselves are reacting to this? So you have lots of different players involved, and the police are sort of being expected to carry out these new ideas and sort of make all sorts of adjustments and see some changes in their discretion and things of that nature. So how are they actually reacting and understanding these reforms?
Right. Well, I think, yeah, the most important thing that I got out of sort of studying the police, you know, and taking them on their own terms through this book is that in each chapter, there's a debate outside of City Hall, in City Hall and out in the city, outside of the police department is what I meant to say, about, you know, what police should be doing. And in each of those chapters, there are then factions that are developing within the police department. And each are aligning themselves with some sort of outside sponsor and trying to leverage, you know, whatever political movement that is or political reaction that is, to advance themselves and to increase their own power. And all of this is having the effect of that all of these, you know, as politics sort of gets confusing and fractures within San Francisco, the sort of general effect is that the police department is growing because each of these factions and each of these chapters is finding some sort of sponsor or patron outside it. That patron or sponsor is advocating a growth of whatever section or niche of the police department they think is going to solve their problem. And so you just sort of get a generalized expansion of power. But there is one sort of main political trajectory in the department and during this period, and that's a shift in power from sort of there are sort of two shifts in power over the course of the book. The first is when the redevelopment advocates come to power and they want to get rid of payola and get rid of discretion. Power is shifted from district station captains to the police chief. The 50s and 60s are this era of police chiefs who are these supposed reformers and they're granted great power and they have great power in City Hall. They're seen as the voice of the police. But during the latter half of the book, and particularly in relationship to what I was just talking about with the tax squad, you get a younger generation of police officers who are, first of all, they no longer have a payola-based relationship with City Hall. In other words, they no longer are looking to City Hall sponsors for promotion based on how much payola they bring in. That's been wiped out from the previous era. And, you know, payola had been certainly extortionary for the citizens, but it had been a means of controlling the police. Police needed their sponsors and needed to sort of keep serving them. Now that relationship is broken, and police particularly this younger generation by the late 60s and early 70s is feeling much more assertive and emboldened and independent. And so you start seeing unionizing not only in San Francisco but elsewhere. And I would say what's unique about San Francisco is that San Francisco's police union is particularly savvy at understanding that if they dial down the public rhetoric about the public anti-gay rhetoric and anti-hippie rhetoric and anti-African-American rhetoric, that if they dial all that down, liberals, you know, and instead sort of accept, if police instead accept pluralism in City Hall, if they accept this notion that City Hall can be a place where all these different groups participate, that liberals will be quite willing to embrace them, will be quite willing to sort of have them join into their coalition. And a lot of unions and a lot of cities, it took them a long time to figure that out. You start seeing it occur more during the 1980s, particularly around community policing. But the San Francisco union is figuring out in the late 60s and by the early 1970s. And so that by the end of the book, you have this pretty strong, that police are part of, on a contingent basis, part of this liberal coalition, that liberals see police as not a group that's a threat to democracy, but as a group that can actually encourage and promote democracy because of their willingness to accept it in City Hall, even though police are not necessarily accepting these principles out on the street.
Okay. I had one other question that I wanted to ask you about some of your arguments that I don't really have a great transition into, but I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about the role of localism, particularly towards the end, and how it's sort of fitting into these larger debates about democracy and control and obviously policing as well.
Right. So, you know, towards the end of the book in San Francisco and then other cities as well, these young white collar people, they're beginning to take power. Their coalitions are beginning to win elections. They're sort of unified around this idea that pluralism is good, that we should have a politics that accepts cultural and sexual and racial pluralism. But when they achieve power, fissures begin to break up, because then the question suddenly becomes, well, how do you promote pluralism? And where should that pluralism occur? Where should we have pluralist debate? People like Al Yodo, as I hinted at earlier, are very much, they believe democracy should be centralized, right? That democracy should occur in City Hall, and that ultimately, you know, the mayor should be the voice of whatever this centralized debate produces, whatever determination it produces. But during the late 60s and then certainly through the 70s and 80s, you have this counter movement amongst other liberals. These are liberals who also promote pluralism, but they argue that pluralism, that democracy, is best fostered in the neighborhoods, out on the street or in the sidewalk, or you know, and that democracy should be decentralized. And you start seeing that politics appear in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury. But it's a politics that's also occurring, as other authors have talked about, in Brooklyn, throughout the country. There you start seeing these pockets, these neighborhoods, and often the liberals in these neighborhoods, they're often young professionals, they're often working in the downtown, but they don't want a democracy organized around City Hall. They want it organized around the neighborhood. And this becomes important, of course, because then it's how does one reform the police? For Al Yodo, police reform should be based on building up centralized policing mechanisms like the tax squad. The tax squad will serve City Hall and will thus be democratic. The localists in the Haight-Ashbury have the completely opposite notion. They want policing not to be centralized, but entirely decentralized. They want to be able to interact with their friendly beat cop, with whom they will cooperatively solve problems in their neighborhoods. Alioto wants to eliminate district stations and sort of move all of policing sort of into one or, you know, a handful of centralized police buildings. Localists want the opposite. They want more district stations, more sort of community outposts where they can, again, cooperatively work with police that they know on a day-to-day basis to solve problems. And this ties into a couple of ideas I've already talked about, namely that police begin to recognize that they can play these two groups off of one another, that when it suits them, they can ally themselves with people like Alioto, who want centralized policing, and they can support those measures. And when it suits them, they can turn around and begin allying themselves with localists. And so, you know, at the end of this story that I describe, you have both, you have police on the one hand getting tax squads, like which they want, but also protecting their district stations, which they want. And this is sort of getting back to that point that I said earlier, where with all these different groups kind of trying to imprint their values on the police department is able to grow and able to sort of buttress itself in different conditions, finding different groups to sort of support its support its own institutional goals. Does that begin to answer your question?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So these questions, and when your book leaves off, of course, these things aren't entirely resolved. These are still questions that are with us today, and your book is incredibly relevant to lots of current political debates. So I was wondering if you might talk just a little bit about what you see as a couple of important takeaways or ways we might consider some of the insights of your book in thinking about present day policing and debates about policing and some of the politics surrounding whether it be localism or use of police force or police community right. relationships, or even obviously lots in the news today at the moment about police relationships with African-American communities as well.
Right. Well, I think on the very specific thing of you know, specific question of particular responses, The liberal debate over centralized versus decentralized reform that grows out of the late 60s is still very much with us now, and you see it in various democratic responses to the protests of Black Lives Matter and the other protests, where, you know, liberals on the one hand, some liberals are arguing for community policing, some are arguing, which is a decentralized method, others are arguing for more professionalization and centralization, especially through body cameras. So that fissure exists with us today. But I would just say more generally, the way that my book relates to the current moment. You know, by the end of my book, you know, so this great disruption of the 50s and 60s is now coming to a conclusion, right? And you have a new set of principles and relationships that police have developed to legitimize themselves. And you can really only understand the massive growth of the police department, of policing in the 70s and 80s, what, you know, a lot of historians are now, you know, associating with the rise of the carceral state. The terms in which the so-called carceral state, and I don't say so-called dismissively, but the term that folks are using, the terms in which the carceral state is rising in the 70s and 80s are established in the story of the 50s and 60s. So I'll explain what I mean. For instance, you in the old system, in the 1950s, you had just a run-of-the-mill, interchangeable beat police officer who was politically voiceless and had access to very broad status-based charges. And you could sort of rely on that officer to sort of march into any situation that bothered you, or not, well, not rely, but there was a system in which cities were relying on these police officers to sort of march into any situation that they felt like, and creating, you know, the order that, as they saw fit. And this was a system that had worked for a lot of cities. But by the late 60s and early 70s, that's not that policy, that program is no longer tolerated, and now police have to abide by harm principle. They have to abide by the harm principle. They have to be professionalized. There's all these sort of benchmarks that liberals are looking for, and so you start getting a profusion of specialized units, and that have sort of this patina of professionalism to them, because they are run out of the Hall of Justice, or they, you know, wear plain clothes and have been trained in some way. And you also have a new, in order for police now to sort of police schools and police public housing projects and police all these other institutions, they now need to be, liberals begin to integrate them into their policymaking practices so that police can sort the harmless from the harmful, so that they can only target so-called, you know, harmful youth. So in the schools in LA, for instance, school district begins bringing police in, whereas in the past, police would have just simply arrested whoever they wanted, sort of would have harassed whoever they wanted. Now there needs to be a policy and a program in which there's sort of this sorting occurring. Police are involved in with school officials, you know, diverting so-called harmful students in one, or at-risk students in one direction, and harmless students in another. So all of this professionalization, all of this integration geared towards sorting harmless and harmful people, alongside a newly politicized police force, or a new, politicized a police force that now advocates for itself, all of this creates a much more expensive system. And you see budgets in the 1970s and 80s balloon, and a much more complex and just massive policing apparatus grows. And it grows because it has to, right? It has to sort of follow these principles that have been established in the 50s and 60s. So that's sort of, in the broadest terms, why I see this book as sort of related to, how I see it related to this current moment. We're still living in the era, we still discuss crime and harm terms, we still discuss policing in terms of professionalization, and that's all a legacy of the late 60s, as is the size and scope of our police system.
Okay. So I have one more question before we wrap up talking about your book. You mentioned a little bit at the beginning that you did a lot of interviews, and one of the things that has, I think it's fair to say at least, kept historians from doing work on policing in the past is that police records are hard to look at, and they're hard to find, and historical police records are often not around. So I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about the experience of doing oral histories for this book, and also just more generally how you're able to really get at some of these thorny issues that are hard to research in the archive.
Yeah. Because I did so much of this, I think part of it was that I lived in the area, and right, I could just, it was back, a lot of this research was back in the era of phone books still, right? it's kind of amazing. It wasn't that long ago.
Right.
I could just cold call people.
Were they happy to talk to you? Or did you meet some
resistance? Well, it depended. I mean, I think, and are we talking about police in particular here? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, the police were interesting. I think the fact that really what you needed was you needed a reference. Mm-hmm. And I found that normally if I had one reference from a police officer that other officers would speak to me. And it was interesting how that worked. It was not always, it didn't necessarily have to be a police officer that they liked, but simply a police officer, and then that would, they would normally take my request. So the main chain that I followed in terms of finding police officers was that, and it was a strange one, I was interviewing an African-American columnist for a black newspaper in San Francisco. And during the late 70s, San Francisco had this sort of very strange political tradition in which white liberal politicians would take on what they referred to as black godparents. And they would have someone they called a godfather or a godmother. And so by chance, I learned that this journalist was the godfather to a former police chief of San Francisco, a guy named Dick Hengisto, who's since passed away. And so that was how I got Hengisto's name and phone number. And then Hengisto was he was quite liberal, I mean, in particularly in comparison to the rest of the police department. He had a lot of names for me and a lot of phone numbers. And these were people who really didn't like Hengisto personally, but once they had heard that he had vouched for me, they were willing to talk. And of course I had the union angle. So, and that was where most of our interview focused usually. And to be honest, wasn't really that interested in finding out if they remembered a particular event from 60 years ago. Mostly I was interested in just how the police department worked, how orders and how direction was given, how power was distributed, what day-to-day policing looked like. And so those were sort of more innocuous topics. I'm a white male and dressed conservatively, so I think that it's impossible to say that that didn't have an effect too on my interactions with them. Police officers I found actually pretty easy to interview. They had a career of talking to, either in court or to journalists. So they were used to talking about these sorts of issues. And as the scholar, it was up to me to kind of think about what they were telling me and to think about it critically. Mm-hmm. So that was why. And I would also say, I'm not sure if it will be as easy for, I was studying a lot of this when police reform wasn't really wasn't such in the public eye. I don't know if police would be more reticent now or not. It's hard for me to say. But during my period, there was no Black Lives Matter movement in the background of me doing my research.
That's very interesting. So thanks for spending lots of time talking to us. I do have one last kind of traditional question, which is, what are you working on now?
So I'm actually doing, I don't know if it's a book or an article or a series of articles, but I'm doing a little bit more work on policing. I'm going to the 1980s and early 90s, and I'm sort of broadly still interested in the relationship between liberals and police. And I'm looking at three cities, Houston, Philadelphia, and Portland, where all of which had democratic administrations during this period, all of which were very different in terms of their economies and sort of demographic makeup, and all of which turned to community policing at roughly the same time. And these cities then became models, and the police chiefs that were heading these cities sort of then branched out to other bigger cities and to the national level. And I'm interested, you know, I think one of the things that I want to do with this project is during the 80s, we tend to talk about, once we start in the 70s, we sort of just talk about the growth of carceral state in just sort of constant terms. But there are successive, you know, what I was saying up front, challenges to the police and to police legitimacy. And what's sort of been lost from the record is how much of a challenge police faced during the early 80s as city government, city budgets began to really atrophy. Through the early and mid 80s, there was a big cutback in police in many cities. And it's an era that we often think of as, you know, this law and order era, but police budgets were being slashed. Number of police officers was declining. And the drug war wasn't really resolving that problem in many cities. But what I'm finding is that community policing was, and that politicians were using community policing in two ways. One, to sort of draw together a huge range of constituencies who wouldn't normally sort of who all sort of saw potential in community policing, but had very different political philosophies and very different social and economic backgrounds. And then from the policing perspective, it was through community policing that you get this sort of recapitalization of police departments, and in particular sort of a buildup of the number of police themselves. And all of my story is occurring before the 94 crime bill, which is frequently cited as and not inappropriately so, but as an important moment where the federal government is coming in and sort of trying to make good on Clinton's promise to put 100,000 new, you know, police back on the street. My point is that this politics wasn't sort of this, and this policy wasn't being dropped down from the White House, that actually that there was 15 years of political activism in cities that were leading towards that moment. So that's my research at the moment.
Well, that sounds great. I look forward to reading it when it comes out.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.